Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, with additional support from NPR member stations.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Europe's migrant crisis has been all over the headlines for months now. Desperate Syrian refugees and more at Europe's doorstep. Outcry when they're beaten back, beaten down. Meanwhile, America's migrant crisis, refugee crisis, has gone silent, but not gone away. The tide of Central American children and more that hit the U.S. southern border in 2014 is now being largely stopped and turned back with American support in Mexico. Stopped, herded, beaten, raped, robbed. It's still out there. We just don't see it. Up next on Point, stopping the tide in Mexico and what that means. First, this news. From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the summer of 2014, America seemed overwhelmed by desperate migrants, many children from Central America. Now it's Europe grappling with a flood of migrants, refugees. But the problems in Central America haven't gone away, nor has the tide of Central Americans setting out for the United States. But now the U.S. has enlisted Mexico to bluntly turn the tide back before it ever gets to the U.S. border. An invisible wave of detention, deportation, and often brutality has gone up across Mexico. We should understand what's going on. This hour on Point, America, Mexico, and the Central American crisis we no longer see. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you think that tide just vanished? What is ethical here? What's not? What should be done? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we'll check in to the North on Canada's hot politics right now and the big election there on Monday with lots of echoes of the U.S. presidential campaign. But first, to the southern border. Remember, in the summer of 2014, all kinds of unaccompanied minors hitting the U.S. border. Here in July, CBS talked to migrants who had been caught in Mexico and sent back to El Salvador.
What are you looking for in the United States? ¿Qué les dices? What do you tell them?
Una vida mejor.
A better life.
You can't have a good life here, she said. There are too many problems, too much crime. Her parents left El Salvador 10 years ago for the U.S. She's been trying to join them ever since. This 16-year-old told us she wanted a better future for her son. It was one of the toughest decisions of my life, she said. But I'm afraid for my son because of the violence and gangs here, so I had to try.
It was a mess that summer at the U.S. border. We all saw it. Now it's a mess on the borders of Europe. How did that shift? What happened to that wave on the U.S. border? Well, here's one clue. In January, President Obama met with the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, in Washington. They talked about the flow of immigrants from Central America trying to get to the United States. Here's Mexico's President Nieto. He says, we will maintain the greater control of the southern border to continue having orderly migration. What does that actually mean? We're going to dive into that today. Joining me now from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Sonia Nazario, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, a winner for her reporting on the trials of U.S.-bound migrants, author of Enrique's Journey. Her essay in Sunday's New York Times was headlined, Refugees at Our Door. You can link to the piece at our website, onpointradio.org. Sonia Nazario, welcome back to On Point. Hello, Sonia, are you there? We just lost that line for a minute. We'll try and get it right back here. In her reporting, she's gone into southern Mexico, where there is now quite a gauntlet for a wave of refugees, migrants, that just keeps coming. The Guardian has been reporting down here, a newspaper out of London, talking about migrants fleeing poverty, violence, institutional collapse, but their way blocked by a Mexican crackdown in recent months, supported by the United States. Sonia Nazario reporting on that as well. She joins us now from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Sonia, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So
For most of us, this is largely invisible. We remember in 2014 all kinds of refugees, migrants, immigrants, many unaccompanied minors, many from Central America who were right on the U.S. border. It was a real crisis that summer, and then it seemed to just somehow vanish. You are looking at the wall, in a way, of stopping these people that's been put up across southern Mexico. You've gone, you've looked at it. What's it look like there, Sonia?
Well, I think out of political expediency, this administration decided that they couldn't have people saying that the border was out of control. President Obama wanted his legacy to be a temporary legalization of 4 to 5 million Americans, or immigrants, rather. An executive order that, by the way, is being held up in the courts. Mm-hmm. And so he pressured, and administration officials pressured Mexico to stop this flow. And what you saw was in June we had this humanitarian crisis of 2014, and July 7th Mexican president announces we are going to crack down, and it has been a ferocious crackdown. The authorities have conducted 20,000 raids of the freight trains that migrants used to ride on top of to get through Mexico. They have raided hotels, they have raided restaurants, places that migrants used in these four southern states of Mexico, and they've reallocated hundreds of immigration officials to the south to stop this wave. So in effect, the U.S. is sponsoring the hunting of these migrants and in some cases sending them back to their deaths, to be quite frank, in Central America. These are some of the most violent places on earth, El Salvador, especially now, Honduras, Guatemala. After Syria, they have the highest kill rates in the world, highest homicide rates. And so many of these children and adults, women, I found, were being sent back by, and in part being because of the pressure from our government and the funding from our government. Taxpayers are paying for this.
And some may say that's just what they want to pay for. Others may be more conflicted about this. Europe has taken a lot of heat this summer for images of refugees being held up at train stations, facing walls and wire. What does it look like? What is this? You know, Hungary took a lot of heat in particular, this sort of periphery of the EU. What does it look like in southern Mexico, in Tabasco, in Veracruz, in Chiapas, in Oaxaca, where this crackdown is going on? Give us a sense of the texture of it.
Sure. Well, first let me say I am not an open borders gal. I believe that we need to control the flow of especially people who are coming here for a better life, as my parents did from Argentina. I call those economic migrants. And I see this issue of immigration, that there are pluses and there are big minuses as well.
Okay.
But a refugee is someone who is being persecuted in their home country. They are fleeing violence. And we know from surveys from the United Nations, at least half of these children, the primary driver for leaving is that they have been threatened once or three times by gangs or narco cartels that control large swaths of these countries. And we know also from women and children who are detained by our government that nearly 9 in 10 pass the initial screening for that they potentially qualify as asylees or refugees. So they have a right to come to this country and ask for refuge, ask for asylum. So I draw a clear distinction there. But in terms of what this looks like in the South, I mean, I rode on top of these freight trains the length of Mexico more than a decade ago, mm-hmm. and they were full of migrants on top of the trains. Now it's very difficult to get on these freight trains. The authorities have built walls alongside the trains so they hold these raids and they can capture these migrants against the walls. They have built posts next to the tracks on both sides, so if you try to run alongside the train and get on, you'll hit one of these posts and be sucked under the train, which has happened to many migrants. They control the train tops with tasers, with electric guns. I talked to migrants who were tasered by immigration officials who, you know, we're partly funding this as when they're on a moving freight train, they are tasered and they say, I can't hold on to anything. And the immigration official, one migrant told me, his name was Dennis, My body felt like it became water. I couldn't hold on to anything. And he shoved me in the chest off of this moving freight train. And luckily, I wasn't sucked down into the wheels, because as these trains move forward, I know this very well, there's a sucking wind under the wheels that pulls you into the wheels as you fall down. They have built structures like an inverted football goalpost over the trains that will sweep you off the freight train in Veracruz as you pass through these structures. Mexico's president says in incredible doublespeak that this is being done to protect the human rights of migrants. But what we've seen is a huge crackdown, an enormous increase in the number of people that they are deporting, and especially children. They deported nearly 20,000 children last year, which was a 117% increase, and they're looking to up that by a lot this year as well. And so what we're seeing, kids like 14-year-old Gredis, who was returned to Honduras by Mexico just in June, and within 24 hours of being in his home back in Honduras, he had two bullets in his head by people who knocked down his door and killed him. He had been threatened by these gangsters, and that's why he had left, and Mexico had sent him back. Mm. So this is what this looks like. This is what our taxpayers are funding, and I'm not normally this passionate about things, but I feel that there are extraordinary times in our nation's history where we need to step up and do the right thing. These are refugees. We have signed protocols saying that we will help refugees, and we demand that other countries like Germany and the EU step up and do the right thing at extraordinary times. But so, we are not doing that. We are doing the opposite.
Sonia, it may be rough, but a lot of what you're describing here, detention, deportation, sounds like law enforcement. But you and others also write a lot about robbery, rape, brutality. This is not crisp, clean border enforcement going on.
No, what's happened is not only has the crackdown happened by Mexican officials, the Migra, the immigration authorities, the federal police, the state police, various units of the police, law enforcement entities in Mexico that have stepped up to do this, but all of the migrants, because they're no longer riding on top of those freight trains, the ones who can't afford $10,000 for a smuggler, they are finding new routes that are often it's harder to get through Mexico. It takes longer, but these are more isolated routes. They're walking the length of Mexico. Children are walking the length of Mexico trying to reach safety in the United States or safety somewhere in Mexico. And so what we've seen is that these delinquents in Mexico, who have always preyed on immigrants, but now there's many more because they've taken the signal from the authorities. It's open season on migrants. You can do whatever you want to them, and they are not being tried and punished by the authorities. And so we've seen a real surge in robberies, 81% increase in robberies of migrants just in the last year in these southern states. And migrants are being kidnapped in extraordinary numbers, 20,000 a year. Many are being kidnapped by these delinquents and gangs and narco cartels.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking, as Europe struggles with a tide of Syrian migrants, about how Mexico is now actively holding a tide of Central American migrants, refugees, away from their target, the borders of the United States. How that works, what it looks like, and what it means. Sonia Nazario is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She's done a lot on migrant refugee flows, asylum seeker flows through Central America and Mexico. Her book is Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. You can join us this hour. Did you think that the Central American tide had just stopped? Do you remember the summer when the borders of the U.S. were flooded with unaccompanied minors from Central America? Do you know what's happening to them now? And many others. Have you, your family members, seen the gauntlet migrants run now in Mexico? The roundups, the abuse, the rape and robbery and deportation back to everything they fled. And I guess the question, is it morally acceptable to have Mexico make the problem go away like this? The situation in Honduras, in El Salvador, sometimes in Guatemala, pretty rough. Here's the BBC in January reporting on the kind of violence that many of these young people are fleeing.
A night patrol in San Pedro Sula, the world's most lawless city. The murder count has just gone up by one. Dumped by a house, the body of a young man. Bound, tortured, then shot. Another gang murder in a city where justice has gone missing.
The stories of brutality there and now beyond are really chilling. Sonia reports survivors of this attempt to get across Mexico now, some being enslaved, working in marijuana fields, others forced into prostitution. Many are killed, she writes. Sometimes they have their organs harvested in what she says has become an invisible, silent slaughter, holding this tide away from American borders. Vice President Joe Biden was in Guatemala in March to support the plan of the Alliance for Prosperity in the Northern Triangle. That's Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, to try and address some of the root problems here. The U.S. pledged $1 billion in its 2016 budget toward the plan, but only a small fraction of that looks like it's actually coming. Here's Biden.
No amount of foreign money can succeed without it coming from within. This time can be different because you're asking to be measured and held accountable for the progress in implementing your own plan.
Not easy, but don't wait on American money. No amount of foreign money, Biden kind of saying there. Sonia Nazario joins us from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And you've got some big allegations in here. Enslavement in marijuana fields, people forced into prostitution, killed, organs harvested, a silent slaughter. Is the evidence there for all that, Sonia?
Absolutely. If you talk to any immigrant community here in the United States, they will tell you of migrants trying to get through Mexico who are kidnapped, and they get a phone call demanding ransom, $2,000 to $5,000, with their child on the line screaming, "Mommy, send the money or they'll kill me," and they're beating them with a club with nails in it. And if after a month you don't pay, they will cut you up in front of all the other people who have been kidnapped. There are 4,000 unidentified bodies that show up in morgues in Mexico every year, and most experts believe the majority of those are Central American migrants. They find large clandestine graves with migrants, and so we're seeing women prostituted who are nabbed, people enslaved to work in marijuana fields, to dig tunnels, to harvest their organs. The stories that you hear, I could not say some of them on the air. They are so atrocious, but it is really, you know, it's I think people don't understand the level of what folks are fleeing in these countries. I had in my story in Sunday's New York Times a woman from San Pedro Sula. You were just talking about this city. Mm-hmm. Her name is Julia Elizabeth Perez, and she was not involved in anything bad in that town, and yet her brother was kidnapped. They robbed the gang that controls that part of San Pedro Sula. They are the law there. There is no government. And they robbed $91 in rent money and cut off his hands and feet. She witnessed, there were three huge massacres within two blocks of her home. Then the 18th Street Gang told her 14-year-old son, they start to recruit these kids at 7, 8, 9 years old, "You're going to join the gang or we're going to kill you." And at 14, they grabbed him as he went on an errand a few steps from his house. And you know, they had asked him to be a lookout, and he said, "No, my mom will be mad at me if I do that." And so they grabbed him and they suffocated him to death. She went 3 hours away to another city to hide. And you know, these gangs have incredible intelligence. They are better at the CIA than this in figuring out who's coming and going from towns. And they tracked her down 7 months later and said, "We're going to kill you." And she fled to Mexico. And I understand that she was at this shelter in southern Mexico where I was at. It took her 20 terrifying days to travel a little more than 200 miles. She walked with her three remaining children, a three-year-old, on her shoulders to try to reach that far. She was shot at by immigration agents on the train. She walked with this child, these children, for days and experienced all sorts of hardships to get that far. And I understand that on Sunday night she was in Tijuana planning to turn herself into U.S. authorities. and ask for asylum, ask for safety from our government. I think it's absolutely true that we need to address the root causes, and there are things that we know work, and I've seen nonprofits start to change things in Honduras. The homicide rate as a result of some of those changes by NGOs like non-governmental organizations like the Association for a More Just Society, 27% drop in homicides in 2 years by attacking corruption, attacking violence, strengthening government institutions, and yet Congress does not want to step up and allocate this $1 billion in foreign aid. They'd rather continue to pour money into walls that, quite frankly, are not effective. Despite what Donald Trump says, 97% of people, per a study at UC San Diego, 97% of folks who try to breach that wall repeatedly are able to do so.
And not just physical walls, but now pouring tens of millions into Mexico and the Mexican government to put up a security cordon in southern Mexico.
That's right. And the State Department official has said in a document that they want to allocate $90 million of your and my taxpayer money to do more of this next year. And What's your answer to this,
Sonia? What would you have them do? We're going to hear in a moment from a former chief of U.S. Immigration, but what would you suggest? This is a lot of people. U.S. numbers of detained Central Americans at the border are way down, but you're writing that is because those numbers are way up in southern Mexico and the treatment sometimes horrific there. What would you do?
Well, first of all, I would urge our congressional leaders and this administration to have a more compassionate policy towards refugees. And today, on moveon.org/border, they're starting a petition as a result of my story to get people to lobby the administration to do that. So I would urge your listeners to go to moveon.org/border. I think that we should do what Germany is doing, which is step up and be a moral leader and say, we are going to redistribute these folks who are fleeing for their lives, redistribute them in Canada, in Latin America, and yes, in the United States. We can afford to take in more than 70,000. We took in 130,000 refugees pre-9/11. Germany, that dinky country in Europe, is going to take in 800,000, 10 times what we take in. I think we can afford to be a little more compassionate, and we need to urge our administration to do that. And I think we do need to address root causes by funding this at $1 billion, as I applaud the administration for suggesting that, but Congress is shredding that proposal to step up and try to fund strengthening these governments and attacking violence and corruption. And we do know some things that will work. We need accountability. We need benchmarks in doing this right. We can't pour money into corrupt institutions. And I think, finally, we need to address our drug use in this country, which we use more illegal drugs than any nation on earth, 1 in 4. And we try to deal with this for decades by saying, just say no, and locking everyone up. We need prevention, we need drug treatment, and we need to consider policies like Portugal of legalization of everything.
For now, the numbers way down from Central America, but that's because of what was sort of antiseptically called stronger border controls in southern Mexico. Sonia Nazar brings to us exactly what that looks like, and it looks very, very rough. Europe has taken a lot of heat for Hungarian policemen at its borders, soldiers sometimes, but look at what's going on in Mexico. What should we do here? Doris Meisner, former chief of U.S. Immigration, joins us in just a moment. A couple of calls first. Amy in Austin, Texas. Amy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. You asked if it was morally acceptable to let another nation do our dirty work, and it's not. And anybody that doesn't understand that should take a transcript of this and go talk to whoever is in charge of the church they worship at, read through it together, and see if they still feel that they can let somebody else do our dirty work and go to church and vote the way they vote and ignore this problem. It is not acceptable. These people are leaving desperate situations behind, just trying to take care of themselves and their families, something we have always respected in this nation.
Amy, I've got it. You say morally unacceptable, and we hear it. Let me get a couple more, if I may. I appreciate your call. Diane in Worcester, Massachusetts. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling in because this revived a memory of something that happened to me on the bus and several incidents since. I've been going in and out of Chiapas since 2005.
Southern Mexico, yeah.
Minimum of 3 months a year, a couple of sabbatical years. Mm-hmm. And you just run up against this in the street, on the bus, even before this enforcement, in the middle of the night, one night on the bus from a mountain town near the border down to Cancun to take the airplane. The Migra came on the bus in the middle of the night. They actually went first to our son, who happens to be Dominican, that had an American passport, and the two of us ready to stand up. And then he sat back down, and they went up to a young woman, and then she left with them. And we thought she was coming back. They were just going to check. We all sat back. It went for a long time. We fell asleep. We woke up. The bus was pulling away. She was not on the bus.
And that's before all of this cranked up.
Alone in the middle of the night between the mountains and the coast, and that's a long time before this crackdown. And then another time, three young men get on the bus in an agricultural region, that same overnight bus. They're taken off. This time, I'm not going to stay on the bus if they don't come back. They're taken off the bus. We're waiting to see what happens. They finally come back. I welcome them. This kid looks at me like, oh, shut up, lady. He was traumatized. His eyes were just, he had terror in his eyes. I don't know if he was sexually assaulted. I don't know if it's just that they took all their money and they were as good as dead when they got off the bus. I don't know.
Diane, we've got it. Whatever it was then, it is by all accounts much more now. One more and we'll go to Doris Meisner. Victor in Boston. Victor, you're on.
Thank you, Tom. What I'm saying is we need to stop the migrants to come through the border of the United States and Mexico, actually. And the reason is because we're funding the cartels. Every single person will pay eventually $4,000 at least to come through, which money goes to...
You mean to coyotes, to people who help them, agents who help them get across Mexico one way or another?
Right. The money is going to go to the cartels. The money is going to go to the corruption. The money is going to go to people who abuses Latinos, who abuses, you know, the desperate situations of people.
So you think it's right to have this crackdown on the Mexican border that stops it there instead of having these?
Yeah, they need to. They need to because it's a big, it's an enormous business that will never stop if we don't tell people, send a sign that it's no more welcome. You know, coming.
But Victor, what about the crises that some of them are facing at home? What about the refugee status they're seeking? What about murder and rape, robbery and rape?
My greatest sympathy. But at the same time, that doesn't justify the fact that you're putting all these people through harm's way just because you want to give them the hope that something's going to be better on the other side. And we're actually not, because look at what's going on right now. We have 11 million illegal immigrants with no papers, no future. Not even a driver's license to go around.
In America.
So, you know, in the United States. So we're talking about people that's not even here, and we don't even take care of the people that's here. So
Victor, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much as well. I want to turn to Doris Meisner right now. She's senior fellow at U.S. Immigration Policy Institute, where it's a non-policy immigration think tank. She was former commissioner chief of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service from 1993 to 2000. Doris Meisner, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
Do you see what Sonia describes happening in southern Mexico? It sounds hellish. Is that your estimate of what's going on?
Well, she's done some amazing reporting, and I've followed her work for years, and I'm very impressed with the work that she's done. So I'm pleased to meet you, Sonia. What she's describing is, you know, personal level, consistent with work that we've done here at the Migration Policy Institute on these flows. And that is that the flows are certainly down this year for the United States, but the overall number, when you look at Mexico's number, is really unchanged from last year. So,
which means they're being caught up in Mexico.
So the whole phenomenon of people leaving and trying to get to the United States has not changed very much. Now, the broader context or sort of history within which to understand this, I think, is two things. First of all, these are mixed flows. These are flows that include people who are most certainly refugees and who should get refugee status or receive safe protection in another country. They are also flows of people who are economic migrants, and their origins are in the 1980s, actually, in the civil wars in the region, in the Central American countries, which has led to a large population of people in the United States who are from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. El Salvador, the largest amount, and then after that, Guatemala and Hondurans. So that the people who are coming to the United States are fleeing terrible human rights conditions. They're also fleeing terrible economic conditions. And they want to get to the United States because they have family members here. 85% of the unaccompanied children that get to the U.S. border have a family member in the United States.
So is the answer to open our borders?
Well, I because of the fact that these are mixed flows, if you open, depending on what you mean by open, by opening the border
to these so-called refugees.
Most certainly people should have the opportunity to apply for refugee status. They should have the chance to have their case be heard. But we also, from a policy standpoint, would not be in a position to say that everybody coming from Central America is a refugee. That's the difficulty.
Right now, there's no discernment. We're just having Mexico basically turn them back, turn them around, and you hear the kind of abuse that has been attendant to that.
That's how I started this off. Mm-hmm. These overall numbers and the overall forces have not changed. Now, what's the best way to deal with it? This Mexican enforcement that's taking place actually dates back far further than just the last year.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking here as Europe struggles with a tide of Syrian migrants about how Mexico is now actively holding a tide of Central American migrants, refugees, away from their target, the borders of the United States. We're looking at how that works, what it looks like, what it means. We'll look in a few minutes at Canada's politics to the north, big election there on Monday. You can join us this hour. What's the answer to this? Are you fine with Mexico's blunt enforcement? Should the U.S. call the Mexicans off and open its borders? Is there a better way? What? Sonia Nazario is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. She has covered this part of the world a lot and this problem a lot. Her latest, an essay in the New York Times. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, with horrific stories out of southern Mexico, where this crackdown has gone on at the behest, in no small part, of the United States. Doris Meisner is also with us, former commissioner, chief of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service herself. She joins us from Washington today. Lots of response online. Nick says these people are fleeing for their lives. They are excellent candidates for becoming naturalized citizens. We've got Charlie says, Sonia, this is a lot here, but among, he says, doesn't your policy of accepting more illegals and refugees just encourage more of the same? And AC is listening to the terrible circumstances in Honduras, El Salvador, and beyond, says, I'm so angry, I'm not sure I should comment, but what is wrong with their leaders, their police, their churches in those countries? These people are tormenting one another at all levels and ages, and no one does anything. What the hell's wrong with this culture, by which he means theirs? A couple of calls, and we'll go to our guest, Chris, in Milwaukee. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom. I guess I don't understand why the United States should bear some sort of overwhelming ethical responsibility for what's occurring. If it's simply proximity, then I suppose that the billions of dollars we're talking about can maybe be better spent in our major American cities, where there is overwhelming poverty and violence.
I mean, the thing is, we're not talking billions. They proposed a billion, but they're not spending it. What they are spending is on holding people at bay. Do you think countries like the United States or Europe, when there are refugees from war, have any moral responsibility to help those in harm's way?
I guess I'm not going to speak to moral responsibility.
But that's what we're talking about here.
Separate issue.
It's not.
We're talking about ethical responsibility. There is a.
Let's call it the same thing for today. There's someone dying, you know, outside your house. Do you open your door to help them or not?
If there's somebody dying outside my house, I suppose I would render aid. If there's somebody breaking into my home, because they fear the potential of violence, and then they say they're going to set up camp in my living room.
Yep.
That's a totally different consideration, and that's what we're talking about here.
Chris, we've got it. Let me hold that one, if I may, and go to Jeff in Madison, Wisconsin. Then, Doris, Sonia, I'll come to you. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, just to indicate, first of all, to answer your question, yes, moral and legal responsibility. We have treaties that we have signed. They are part of our law. And pre-9/11, we used to be a welcoming country. Post-9/11, we have really fallen off. I, for the data I could get on the 156 countries for which I could get data as refugees as a percentage of population, we come in at number 75.
What would you do here with Central America, Jeff?
I'm sorry?
What would you do in this case with Central Americans fleeing?
They are refugees. They are entitled through international law and the laws, that the treaties we have signed, to let them in and give them protection. That is part of our law. That is what we have signed. And I just wanted to say that Switzerland, Canada, UK, Australia all have higher percentages, but so do Sudan and Mauritania and Congo and Liberia. They all accept more as a percentage of their population. We are just shirking our moral and legal responsibility.
Jeff, we've got it. Doris Meisner, what would you do here? It's a big problem for these people. Their countries are kind of a mess in many ways. We don't want to see them suffering in Mexico, but what's the answer?
Well, it is a big problem, and it is, in many ways, all of the things that have been talked about. We have to think of this and understand this as a regional issue. This is an issue that deals with the United States, Mexico, the three countries of Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. We are tied together initially through the drug traffic and through the violence that comes about because of drugs, which is now located much more fully in Central America. It is still in Mexico, but Mexico's efforts to expel the drug violence has moved into Central America and then become fused with existing gang and other issues there. So these migrants are a product of that much bigger problem that has affected us through a market that involves all of these countries. Now, Mexico is part of that. Mexico has a right and a responsibility to enforce its borders just the way the United States has asserted a right and responsibility to enforce its borders. But we all need to do it in ways that makes it possible for humanitarian cases to have access to our systems. And none of us are doing that as fully as we ought to be doing it. It obviously needs to be strengthened in Mexico dramatically.
Does that mean call off the Mexicans? Can we say to them, get more discriminating? We want to see transcripts of your nice conversations with these people in clean, well-lighted places where they describe their stories and you filter the legitimate refugees. Can we do that?
We can do a whole range of things, but these are long-term building capacity and answers. We've got to work in the region through the Alliance for Prosperity, building citizen security, rule of law in those countries. We have to work in Mexico to reduce the corruption, to create much more professionalism in their law enforcement.
It sounds like such a long path.
And we need to work in the United States, not only on humanitarian screening and timely refugee procedures, but on solving our own immigration problems, because the families of these people who are in the United States are almost entirely people without legal status, which means that it's impossible under our laws for family unification to take place, and the split families and the effort to get to the United States to reunite is something that can't take place under our current broken system. That needs to be fixed as well.
Sonia, we've just got a couple of minutes here. Those are long-term solutions and big challenges as much as solutions. Clearly, Doris is right. They have to be addressed. You're looking more immediately. What would you say right now?
Well, I think if we're going to fund the sorts of things that we've been funding, which, by the way, a researcher, Elizabeth Kennedy, has found that in 21 months, 90 people by the U.S. and Mexico have been sent back to their deaths, and those are just the ones that surface in the media in Central America. That's the direct result of our policies right now.
We've got 1 minute. What would you do?
I would also fund efforts by Mexico to determine who is in danger, have more of an effort to screen for asylum. It's virtually impossible to get asylum right now in Mexico and apply for a humanitarian visa to get to the U.S. border and claim asylum here. So I think we need to pay for humane places for Mexico to hold people who are waiting the outcome of their petitions for refugee status. And I think we need to set up a system at our border where we screen people. The EU is setting up a system right now. You screen people and you see, do they potentially qualify as a refugee? And if they do, you let them in and you let them go through the court process in the
United
States.
But these people don't even come close to our border.
And if they don't qualify, then send them back. If they are not, if they are an economic migrant, deport them. Send them back. But if they are a refugee, give them a chance to prove that in the United States of America. Let's step up and be a leader. Let's abide by the protocols and the laws that we have signed saying that we will do that.
I guess right now we wouldn't even know if they're turned back in the mountains of southern Mexico under circumstances that you describe as pretty darn rough. What a mess. Sonia Nazario, author of Enrique's Journey, Pulitzer Prize winner, thank you very much for being with us today, Sonia.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Doris Meisner, former commissioner of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, now at the U.S. Immigration Policy Institute. Thank you very much, Doris, for joining us today.
Thank you.
In a moment, we check in on the upcoming Canadian election. This is On Point. On Monday, Canadians will head to the polls to decide the country's next prime minister. It's been a fiercely fought race. Incumbent Stephen Harper of the Conservative Party, who's been called Canada's George W. Bush, is facing off against the Liberal Party's 43-year-old Justin Trudeau, whose father Pierre was prime minister of Canada, and the new Democrat Party's Thomas Mulcair. The issues? Deficit spending, infrastructure, troop deployments, immigration. Sound familiar? Campbell Clark is chief political writer for the Globe and Mail, joins us now from Ottawa in Canada. Campbell Clark, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So describe the era that Canada's just been through under Prime Minister Stephen Harper. It has been maybe more conservative in his tone and focus than most Americans associate with Canada.
I think it's been more conservative than most Canadians associate with Canada, at least before Stephen Harper came to power. And it's as much in tone and style as it is in terms of policies, you can't say that Canada has taken a dramatic shift right in terms of its, budgets and fiscal policies. But, the style, where Mr. Harper's been more pro-military, tough on crime, talking very aggressively about terrorism, more about security, and low taxes. These are things that, were a little bit outside, not outside the discourse, but his emphasis is outside the discourse. 10 years ago, the average sort of political discourse, the middle of the discourse was, sort of what you'd heard in the Democratic presidential debate the other day. Mr. Harper's discourse is a bit more like the Republican Party, at least without Donald Trump.
How do some of these things come into play? Military, for example. We know the U.S. goes to war. We think of Canada as being something different on that front, and yet I'm seeing one of his challengers, Mulcair, saying something like, Mr. Harper, you never met a war you didn't like.
He did say that, yes. And I think Canadians have a perception of themselves as being, taking part in peacekeeping missions rather than war, which is not accurate, in fact, but Mr. Harper was very vocal about taking part in the war in Afghanistan, at least at first. He did withdraw Canada later, but also sent Canadian jets to bomb in Libya and the military mission against Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And Justin Trudeau, his main opponent in this mm-hmm. election, says he'd pull those jets back. So that has been a difference in tone in Canadian politics. Usually, when there's been an allied mission since Mr. Harper took power, Canada has gone.
Here's the Liberal Party leader, Justin Trudeau, going after referencing the new Democrat leader, Mulcair, but also talking about Stephen Harper and his attitude toward jumping in when there's military conflict.
Yeah. We have been positive throughout this campaign, open, talking about our plan for growth for the middle class, the only party that's going to cut taxes for the middle class, the only party that's putting more money in the pockets of 9 out of 10 Canadian families. We're going to remain positive because Canadians deserve a vision of this country that brings people together and tells the truth instead of Mr. Harper's approach.
Sorry, there's the economy. Here's Trudeau on Canadians more or less at war.
Mr. Mulcair has said he doesn't think we should be in this fight at all. Mr. Harper hasn't seen a fight in the Middle East that he hasn't wanted to send Canadian troops into, starting with 2003 and George W. Bush's Iraq War. The Liberal Party, as we have in the past, know that Canada has an important role to play on the world stage and should be a strong partner in this coalition. But we disagree with Mr. Harper about the best way to do it in terms of dropping bombs.
Kemble Clark, so what now? Is there a sea change afoot here again? This is so tight, maybe no one knows. Is Prime Minister Harper's time coming to an end?
It does sort of look that way now. It's not entirely clear because we have three main parties in Canada and a couple more that can actually affect the outcome. But the Liberals have pulled ahead in the polls. It looks like they'll win what's called a minority government here, which means that the Prime Minister can't govern alone. He needs some support from other parties in Parliament. You never know. In Canada, 4 days away from an election, things can shift, and things sometimes do shift dramatically over the last weekend. But right now, Mr. Trudeau is ahead, and Mr. Harper has become such a polarizing figure that if he doesn't win a majority in Parliament, he's going to have a hard time hanging on.
The issue of Islamophobia has become a campaign issue, at least around Muslim women covering their heads in Canada. How's that come up?
Well, this is a strange sort of symbolic issue that that pushed its way in a big way into the campaign for a period of time. It's about Muslim women wearing the veil, the niqab, mm-hmm. at citizenship ceremonies when they're being sworn in as citizens. Now, there was a rule that the Conservatives adopted sort of administratively that women could not wear the veil during these ceremonies, and a couple of people, too, in fact, challenged it, and it was ruled unconstitutional by the sort of middle-level courts in Canada. And so the Conservatives said, well, we'll pass a law to stop that, and it became a big symbolic debate, especially in the province of Quebec, where the Separatist Party took it on in a big way, about whether women in Canada should be allowed to wear the veil at all in terms of, you know, when they're working in the public service or when they're, you know, going to get public services like applying for a driver's license. It became more of a symbolic debate about Muslim immigration, about security. Well,
kind of an echo of France there, which has had a lot of turmoil over this issue. And the TPP is a big deal in this debate. How's that breakdown, Kemble?
Well, it came up, and it kind of came and went to a certain extent. But anyway, the deal was signed, you know, just in the midst of our election. It was signed by a Prime Minister, Mr. Harper, who's very pro-trade. The party on the left, the NDP, who were falling in the polls, decided that they would take it on and fight against it. Now, Mr. Trudeau has more or less said he's pro-trade, but has not given it a definitive position. But you'll see that you know, they've taken the sort of traditional positions. At one time, it looked like Mr. Harper would get a lot of credit for having concluded that deal, but it seemed to last just a day or two. And Mr. Mulcair seemed like, well, he planned to take this on in a big way and use that to sort of finish his campaign and shore up his support on the left, but it doesn't seem to have taken off.
So sometime Monday, will we see if the Harper age has come to an end? Is that what's at stake here?
I think that is what's at stake here, and that's certainly what we'll be seeing Monday night. Whether or not it's over.
The Conservative Stephen Harper fighting to stay on as Prime Minister of Canada. We shall see. Kemble Clark is chief political writer at the Globe and Mail, joined us from Ottawa. Kemble, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.